Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
His name is Alexander Butterfield. He was the deputy assistant to President Richard Nixon. And as the surprise witness during the Watergate hearings in 1973, he changed the course of history with this moment.
Mr. Butterfield, are you aware of the installation of any listening devices in the Oval Office of the President?
I was aware of listening devices. Yes, sir.
It was Alexander Butterfield who told Watergate investigators and the world about the existence of secret White House tapes that would ultimately expose Nixon's involvement in the Watergate plot and lead to his resignation. If there's a modern equivalent to what Alexander Butterfield did that day, it is this person, Cassidy Hutchinson, the White House aide who testified to the January 6th committee about what she saw happen inside the White House before, during, and after January 6th. Today, we learned that the similarities between Butterfield and Hutchinson are no accident. This is from the newly released transcript of Cassidy Hutchinson's closed-door testimony before the January 6th committee. Here's what she said about how she ultimately made the decision to testify before the public. Quote, I start Googling Watergate. Like, there has to be somebody that participated in Watergate that either had a similar job to me and had exposure. Like, how did they handle this? I didn't know that much about Watergate, but then I came across this man named Alex Butterfield, and it looked like he had a similar role and title to what I had in the White House. I found that he, a couple years ago, worked on this book with Bob Woodward, so I ordered two copies. I read it three times. He had talked about how he fought the moral struggle, where he felt like he still had to be loyal to the Nixon White House. He talked about a lot of the same things that I felt like I was experiencing. The emphasis he, Butterfield, placed on the moral questions that he was asking himself resonated with me. He was somebody who did know things and who was loyal and who had a position that required an incredible amount of trust and confidence, but he ended up doing the right thing. And it was after I read this, I was like, if I'm going to pass the mirror test for the rest of my life, I need to try and fix some of this. Cassidy Hutchinson wasn't being hyperbolic about the level of courage it took for her to testify that day. Today, we learned from her transcript the incredible amount of pressure that Trump world had placed on her not to answer the committee's questions and instead risk contempt of Congress in order to protect Donald Trump. Hutchinson told the committee that her Trump-funded lawyer, a man named Stephen Passantino, actively discouraged Hutchinson from telling the committee everything that she knew. At one point, Hutchinson recalls attempting to organize her thoughts by asking to look at a calendar so she could better remember what events took place and when. She says the Trump attorney, Mr. Passantino, discouraged her from trying to jog her memory. According to her testimony, he told her, "I'm your lawyer. I know what's best for you. The less you remember, the better. Don't read anything to try to jog your memory. Don't try to put together timelines." That same Trump lawyer also told Cassidy Hutchinson not to tell the committee about the harrowing incident in which Trump allegedly lunged at the wheel of his SUV and at the leader of his Secret Service detail when the agent refused to take Trump to the Capitol following his speech on the Ellipse on January 6th. As she told the committee, quote, "I said something to Stephen like, yeah, I had this conversation with Tony Ornato," that's Trump's deputy chief of staff, "when we got back from the rally that day, and Tony told me that the president tried to wrap his hands around the Secret Service agent's neck and strangle him because he wouldn't take him to the Capitol." And Stephen said, "No, no, 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 no." I remember he like sat back in his chair and he's like, "No, no, 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 no. We don't want to go there. We don't want to talk about that." That is the kind of legal advice that staffers, people who relied on the former president's network of legal counsel, that is the kind of advice they were getting as the January 6th committee concluded its work. And as we learned from Cassidy Hutchinson's transcript today, it wasn't just the pressure from those Trump-approved lawyers to avoid telling the committee what she knew. Hutchinson told the committee that she was also receiving offers of financial support and promises of offers for jobs, that jobs that didn't actually exist, and what she felt like was an attempt to buy her silence. But Cassidy Hutchinson did not acquiesce to the pressure or the job offers or the attempts to buy her silence. Instead, she says she found herself doing something that very few Trump aides have proved capable of or interested in over the years. She started soul searching. She started thinking about her role in President Trump's scheme and who she was becoming in the process. Quote, "I was sitting on my couch in my old apartment. It looked out over the bullpen and the Navy Yard near the Nat Stadium. I remember sitting there, reading on my phone like this, glancing out the window, and I just kept thinking, oh my God, I became someone that I never thought I was going to become." That self-reflection, that was how Cassidy Hutchinson found the courage to ditch that Trump-backed lawyer and find new representation and testify before an audience of millions and tell the country and the world what she knew. Tonight, we received even more witness transcripts from the committee, which we will get to later on in this hour. And we are expecting the release of the committee's full January 6 report. But the testimony of Cassidy Hutchinson alone paints a damning picture of how Trump and his allies may have pressured witnesses in an attempt to obstruct the investigation. And her testimony further shows us the extent to which those witnesses may have felt Trump himself was running the pressure campaign. As Hutchinson told the investigators, she was nervous in her first interviews with the committee because, quote, "I almost felt like at points Donald Trump was looking over my shoulder." Joining us now are Kyle Chaney, senior legal affairs reporter for Politico and former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan, and MSNBC legal analyst Barb McQuaid. It's great to have you both here tonight. Thank you for making the time on what has been just an unseasonably insane news cycle filled with absolutely explosive information. Kyle, let me start with you first in terms of this Cassidy Hutchinson testimony. Some of this stuff, a lot of this stuff, we sort of knew the foundational aspects. But the sort of the gripping personal narrative here, the sense of fear, the sense of desperation, the anguish that this woman was put through in the process of coming out to tell the truth is remarkable. What surprised you most about the testimony as you read it for the first time in full?
Yeah, I think it was really just the committee's choice about putting this out on its own. And I think that it was intentional. It was to get people to look specifically at this personal journey that she was on amid this chaotic period, both in her life and in sort of the life of the country, as the select committee is unearthing new information and new evidence about what happened. I remember when we first learned about Cassidy Hutchinson, it was in a court filing about Mark Meadows, trying to get Mark Meadows, the chief of staff, to come in and testify. And we said, wow, she has a lot of information about what members of Congress were saying and doing during this crazy period before January 6th. And little did we know that that was during a point where she felt like the best information she had, she was still keeping to herself because of the advice of her lawyer. And so now to hear the story in full, to see that even while she was providing incredible information to the committee, how much she was withholding because of what her lawyer was telling her, I think it fills in that narrative and explains why we saw this slow and but increasingly explosive series of revelations from her culminating in that public testimony.
Kyle, I got to ask you, in the Hutchinson sort of explains how she comes around to this Trump-approved lawyer. Initially, she does not want to be represented by anyone in Trump world. She goes to her estranged father in New Jersey and effectively begs him for funds so that she can have her own counsel that's not affiliated with Trump. She doesn't have the money. She ends up capitulating effectively to Trump world and getting a free lawyer, a lawyer whose bills are being paid for ultimately by the Trump organization. And I mean that with a lowercase o. Does it surprise you that it took as long as it did for Trump and his acolytes to get their claws into Cassidy Hutchinson, given how much she actually knew? For a while, she's just kind of dangling out there, left to her own sort of moral anguish, trying to figure out whether she actually wants to be affiliated with anyone, any counsel from Trump land. I was surprised that they didn't immediately recognize how valuable she would be as a witness.
Yeah, I think this story has sort of played itself out several times with other witnesses too. You know, we see people like John Eastman, for example, someone we think of as closely tied to Donald Trump's effort to overturn the 2020 election. Well, he spent months in court trying to prove that he actually worked for Donald Trump during the post-2020 election period. And, you know, the judge in that case said, hey, can you show me that you actually had a relationship with Donald Trump? And he couldn't even get someone in Trump's orbit to vouch for him that he, oh, yeah, by the way, this guy was our lawyer. This seems to happen over and over again. Although I'd say, you know, Cassidy Hutchinson's plight, what these sort of mid-level staffers go through when there's these investigations and these sort of extraordinary efforts to probe the previous administration that happen all the time. It's not just a Trump phenomenon. They do struggle, and sometimes they are forced to take unfavorable legal arrangements because it's expensive. You can spend many, many thousands of dollars or more trying to defend yourself, and sometimes that's the easiest way out.
And that was, for a time, the path that she chose. Barb, I have to ask you about what the DOJ can do with some of this. First and foremost, this notion, the fear that was felt by Cassidy Hutchinson, it made me think immediately of a crime syndicate, which is a phrase that has been used in conjunction with the Trump White House. I want to read an excerpt from the transcript. This would be a full screen four for my control room. It wasn't just that I had Stephen Passantino sitting next to me, says Hutchinson. It was almost like I felt like I had Trump looking over my shoulder, because I knew in some fashion it would get back to him if I said anything that he would find disloyal. And the prospect of that genuinely scared me. You know, I'd seen this world ruin people's lives or try to ruin people's career. I'd seen how vicious they can be. What is there to be done with that if you're the DOJ and working on your own investigation into January 6th right now?
Well, there's certainly the potential there for witness tampering. You know, intimidating a witness to lie is a crime. It's an obstruction of justice statute. And so I don't know that you can read the face of this and say, oh, there it is, there's the crime. But I think that there is certainly sufficient questions to be asked. I would want to ask Cassidy Hutchinson, what caused you to feel this way? What were the things that were said to you? Who said them? What did they say? How many times did they say them? But some of the things that her lawyer, Stephen Passantino, is reported to have said, according to Cassidy Hutchinson herself, is don't commit perjury. Just say you don't recall, because they don't know what you can and can't recall, even though she could recall things. I mean, that really is coaching a witness to lie. So it's kind of two different things. Telling her to lie would be one crime, and then intimidating her or promising her things, inducements, a job, other things, could also be witness intimidation. So I think it requires additional information. You know, is any of this documented in her deposition testimony? It appears that there were text messages coming from some of these lawyers with some of these assurances. That would be some dynamite evidence that could back up her witness testimony. So I think that there's absolutely grounds there to investigate for witness intimidation. And I'll tell you what else. If they did it to Cassidy Hutchinson, I am wondering who else they did it to and who else didn't have the courage to say no.
Yeah, absolutely. Every time you read in those transcripts, I don't recall. You got to think, is that legal coaching? Is that from Trump world? Is that the pressure campaign? Barb, to your end, the carrot and the stick approach that seems to be employed by some of the Trump affiliated counsel. We know what the stick is. Cassidy Hutchinson is worried about her career being ruined. But the carrot, the incentives, the offers of financial support and the jobs. I want to read another excerpt from the transcript. This would be the sixth quote, full screen six for the control room. I remember Justin Clark saying something to the effect of, you know, and Justin Clark is affiliated with Trumpland, to the effect of, you know, it feels like we're not taking care of you, Cass, but I promise you we are. Like, we're on your team. We're going to get you a really great job. You don't have to worry financially about the second subpoena and this interview. Like, everything is going to be covered. Don't worry. Just keep up the good work. No one is mad at you. Just keep doing what you're doing. I mean, Barbara McQuaid, that seems on its face like tampering with a witness.
Yeah, so the key there is to show that the person had a corrupt intent. Certainly lawyers coach legitimately, ethically, clients all the time. Clients are nervous when they're testifying. And they might be told, you're doing great. Just answer the questions. You know, tell the truth. You're doing fine. That's all okay. But if there is a corrupt intent, that is, I either said wonderful things to you to entice your good behavior and loyalty, or I threatened you or tried to intimidate you that something bad would happen if you didn't go along with the plan, in an effort to influence her to tell something other than the truth. That's when it's a crime. And so, just on their face, it raises an eyebrow. You'd want to ask more questions. But when you have to prove a crime beyond a reasonable doubt, typically prosecutors are going to want more than just one witness here, like Cassidy Hutchinson. They're going to want some sort of corroboration. So that's why seeing it in documentation can be so valuable.
Kyle, talk to me about how you're seeing the release of this particular set of transcripts from Cassidy Hutchinson, not her first deposition in front of the committee, right? The first two and a half are basically under duress, if you will, if you believe her testimony, that she was being coached by Trump counsel not to be fully truthful with the committee. The committee has chosen to release this set of transcripts first. And we know that they released 34 transcripts yesterday, mostly of people pleading the fifth. This is the first one that has some honest-to-goodness answers, and boy, are they bombshells. How are you interpreting this kind of rollout from on behalf of the committee, given the fact that we also don't yet have their 900-page full report?
Well, just one small point to make is that right at the outset of this transcript, they make a point to say, by the way, we know you've already shared this information with the Justice Department. So they're flicking ahead to what they know is the next chapter in all this, which will be the DOJ investigation that is well underway and will surpass what the committee can do ultimately. But I think, look, they recognize how important Cassidy Hutchinson was to their overall investigation and that these were some of the outstanding questions where, look, she faced challenges to her veracity after her public testimony, mostly from anonymous people who wanted to challenge her in ways that haven't really been haven't held up under scrutiny or been fully substantiated. And she's taken a lot of that exactly what she talked about was that those attacks from Trump world that she was so worried about privately. We saw them in full view after her public testimony. And so I think they wanted to show that she had a lot more to say. She had a fuller story about how she ended up where she did, why she ended up in that chair at the end of June and delivering that explosive testimony that was a lot more complicated than we may have realized at that time, from what we knew when she appeared on June 28th.
Yeah, I think the sacrifice that this woman was willing to make in the name of truth and honoring democracy is something that we should all appreciate. It is an extraordinary journey that she went on largely alone. And I think all of us should applaud her for that. Kyle Chaney and Barb McQuaid, please do stick with me. We have so much more to talk about this evening. As we mentioned, in addition to Cassidy Hutchinson, the committee late tonight released the transcripts of five other witness interviews, including those of Trump Defense Secretary Mark Esper and Trump Deputy Press Secretary Sarah Matthews, who resigned her position on January 6th. What they told the committee in those interviews, plus what this new avalanche of evidence being released by the committee means for the DOJ's ongoing investigation into Trump's efforts to stop the peaceful transfer of power. That is all coming up next. Stay with us.
Hey, Keurig coffee drinkers. Need a cold coffee with a bold flavor? Dunkin' Cold K-Cup pods were specially crafted for cold coffee. Brew over ice straight out of the Keurig coffee maker for smooth, delicious Dunkin' taste you know and love. Find your next Dunkin' Cold coffee in the roasted coffee aisle.
When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
So it was obvious that the situation at the Capitol was violent and escalating quickly. And so I thought that the tweet about the vice president was the last thing that was needed in that moment. And I remember thinking that this was going to be bad for him to tweet this because it was essentially him giving the green light to these people, telling them that what they were doing at the steps of the Capitol and entering the Capitol was okay, that they were justified in their anger. And he shouldn't have been doing that. He should have been telling these people to go home and to leave and to condemn the violence that we were seeing.
That was Sarah Matthews, deputy press secretary of former President Trump, testifying this summer to the January 6th committee about what led her to walk out of the Trump administration on that day. While we've been awaiting the release of the January 6th committee's final report, the panel has released more than 2,000 pages of transcripts from 40 different witnesses as of today. That includes five new transcripts hot off the presses tonight. And in this most recent batch of transcripts is explosive testimony from Mark Esper, Trump's former Secretary of Defense, Ken Klukowski, a former attorney for Trump's presidential campaign, who joined the Justice Department just a few weeks before January 6th and was immediately embroiled in schemes to keep Trump in power, and a transcript from Sarah Matthews, who worked under Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany. In her closed-door interview with the committee in February, Matthews testified that after Trump sent that incendiary tweet about how Vice President Pence didn't have the courage to do what should have been done after he was repeatedly told to encourage the violent crowd to stay peaceful, Trump was resistant. Here's what Matthews told the committee. Question, did Ms. McEnany describe in any way how resistant the president was to including something about being peaceful? This is Matthews. Just that he didn't want to include it, but they got him to agree on the phrasing, stay peaceful. Matthews then summarizes this exchange with the Trump aide as the team decided whether or not to condemn the violence on that day. Matthews says, I relate again that I thought it needed to have a forceful condemnation of the violence and that there needed to be a call to action to ask people to leave the Capitol. And it was in a room in the press office where others were gathered, and a colleague of mine suggested that he not condemn the violence. Question, who was that colleague? This is Matthews. Chad Gilmartin. Okay. Matthews again. There's a reasoning behind that, but okay. Matthews again. His reasoning was that he felt like by condemning the violence, it acknowledged that these were his supporters and that it would let the media, quote, win, end quote. Because what he expressed was that over the summer, we had seen violent protests across the country by Black Lives Matter protesters and that Democrats were never asked to condemn that violence. Those are just some of the top lines from that transcript. As for Ken Klukowski, the deposition transcript that was just released is peppered with privilege objections and repetitions of I do not recall. But between all those objections and apparent memory lapses, Klukowski did acknowledge that he was the lawyer who drafted an infamous letter on behalf of his then boss, former DOJ official Jeff Clark, the loyalist Trump wanted to install as attorney general, as Trump plotted a way to remain in power. The committee describes that letter as a proof of concept letter to the state of Georgia, asking them to look into election related issues. A proof of concept letter. We know that that letter was riddled with bogus claims of election fraud. Back with us for more on the revelations in these transcripts are Kyle Chaney, senior legal affairs reporter for Politico, and former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan, Barb McQuaid. Barb, proof of concept letter for how to pressure states into sending slates of fake electors to overturn an election. I mean, is admitting to helping to draft a proof of concept letter for such a thing? I mean, is there a criminal act in there somewhere that you would imagine DOJ is examining?
Absolutely. Because, you know, this isn't just a draft letter for a legal purpose. This was the letter that was going to suggest to states that Biden had won, that were swing states, that the legislatures reconvene for the purpose of selecting their own slate of electors based on irregularities the Justice Department had found. This is after the Justice Department had found no irregularities. To the contrary, they had found that there had been no widespread fraud. So the letter contained a lie. And they knew it contained a lie. So that part of it, I think, is potentially criminal. The other really important thing about the role of Ken Klukowski here is when it comes up through Jeffrey Clark and the Justice Department, it looks like it is originating organically over there. But what we didn't know until he testified was that he was a link between Jeffrey Clark and John Eastman. He had previously worked for John Eastman. He didn't begin working at the Justice Department until December of 2020, just weeks before the administration was to end. What purpose could he have had to show up and start a new job with weeks left in the administration, unless he's there to do the bidding of John Eastman? And so when it comes up through Jeffrey Clark, this is sort of the same way Donald Trump says, I don't need Volodymyr Zelensky to really investigate Joe Biden. I just need you to announce that you're going to investigate Joe Biden. It's kind of the same thing. I don't really need there to be fraud. I just need the Justice Department to say there's fraud, because once the Justice Department says so, people are going to believe it. So it's essentially laundering the John Eastman theory through the Justice Department. And Ken Kluchowski is the glue between those two segments.
Yeah, Ken Kluchowski is brought in effectively for a surgical strike. He even says he's just there for a little while before he tries to go to the private sector. That's later on in the transcript. But he did not have long-term plans for staying in the Justice Department. He had a mission to fulfill by his own admittance. The other thing that's part of the lion's share of Ken Kluchowski's transcript, Kyle, is the phrase, "I do not recall." And I feel like there's a reason that the media and the American public were given the Cassidy Hutchinson testimony about the ways in which Trump appointees and Trump affiliates were coached to say, "I do not recall," when they were under pressure to give damning evidence against Donald Trump. Are you reading these tea leaves the same way? The fact that we are primed with this knowledge from Cassidy Hutchinson and then given a transcript from someone, Ken Kluchowski, where he says repeatedly, "I do not recall, I do not recall, I do not recall."
I think you're right that that's the inference that the committee wants people to draw when you flip from Cassidy Hutchinson and her explanation to Ken Kluchowski, where, I mean, there are some moments in there that you slap your head and say, how can you not recall? There were questions about, were you asked to brief the vice president on, you know, strategies to potentially overturn the election? He says, "I don't remember." And he said, "Is that really something you wouldn't remember?" And he says, "Well, I probably would have remembered had it happened, but I just don't recall. And so therefore it probably didn't happen." But it's some of these things that sort of strain credulity. Now, he's a lawyer, so he may be being very careful with his words in a way that maybe Cassidy Hutchinson was not as measured about. But you see it over and over and over again. And as you pointed out, Ken Kluchowski was only at DOJ for about a month. Barely a month, and was there for an extraordinarily chaotic and intense time, was drafting this letter, this extraordinary letter at the center of all these January 6th investigations, and now can't remember almost anything about it. So it really is just an eye-opening exchange.
Well, you talk about the conversations that Ken Kluchowski can't recall. Yes, there's a conversation he's asked about whether or not he talked to the vice president about January 6th. He's also asked whether Ginny Thomas, the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, who we know was very active in the Stop the Steal movement, was very active in trying to push supporters to the Capitol or to the rally on January 6th. He says he doesn't recall any conversations with Ginny Thomas about January 6th. I thought it was really interesting that the committee is asking about Ginny Thomas. We know there has been interest in having Ginny Thomas testify. That clearly, we don't think that's happened. Is that right, Kyle?
Well, they did bring her in for a sort of closed door interview that as far as I understand it, was not particularly fruitful. They didn't learn anything from her that they hadn't already sort of assumed before she went in or hadn't seen in the text messages. But the fact that they're asking about her and this interview with Ken Kluchowski was in June, and it's actually their second deposition with him. The first one we still don't have the transcript of, but they called him back for a reason and they asked him about Ginny Thomas, I think because she had bubbled up to the surface as more of an interesting player to them at around that time.
Barb, can we just talk about Ginny Thomas for a moment? Because she is a name that is often in the ether. There's all kinds of conflict of interest questions I think a lot of us have as it pertains to her being active on January 6th and in and around fraudulent election claims and her husband being a Supreme Court justice who has to deal with a lot of these very same issues. Do you think the DOJ has Ginny Thomas on its list as persons, on its list of persons of interest?
I think so. I don't know how much they'll pursue it. I think what they want to do, they'll start by looking at the transcript from her deposition when she was interviewed to see if there's any substance there that they need to pursue. I also think it's really important for them to look at her email exchanges with Mark Meadows. We've seen some of those publicly where she was urging him in very religious, biblical fervor that you have to stop this evil from taking place, the stolen election. And so I think you'd want to ask her about that. You know, she's says that she and her husband operate in separate spheres. They have their own careers and they do separate things. But I have to wonder whether she gets an audience with the chief of staff of the president if she is not married to a Supreme Court justice. There's even a message where she makes a reference to discussing the matter with her friend, which some have suggested is coded language for Clarence Thomas. And so I think that it is something that's worth exploring, to what extent she is trying to exercise undue influence. We know that there was also a suggestion that Clarence Thomas might be the only justice who would be willing to go along with their bid to take a lawsuit directly to the Supreme Court. I don't know whether it means he's corrupt. It probably just means that he might be receptive to the legal theory. So I don't know that we know she's done anything wrong, but I think it's there's enough smoke there that I think they'd want to look to see whether there's fire.
Just real quick, Barb, in terms of the amount of evidence we have here, and I will say the trail of breadcrumbs, a number of people saying, I don't recall, knowing what we know about what that response might mean, the number of people taking the fifth on basic questions. What kind of table is set for the DOJ as they continue their investigation as special counsel Jack Smith, who by all outside accounts is a fairly tenacious prosecutor? What kind of table is set for them as they move forward on this investigation that's now getting wrapped up by the House?
Well, it seems very apparent that many of these witnesses are not going to be terribly cooperative. You know, that they showed up because they felt they had to, but they were not forthcoming. They are not being helpful. You know, there's even a part of the Cassidy Hutchinson testimony where she said she was coached by Stephen Palantino to say, you know, unless every aspect of a question is correct, your answer should be no. So, for example, if they ask you, do you host a television show on MSNBC nightly that pertains to the news that comes on at 8 p.m., you know, what he would want her to say is to just simply say, nope, as if like that's the end of it. You should move on. A normal person would say, I do host a show, but it's not at 8, it's at 9, right? And so instead, what he wanted to do to them, if any aspect of the question was incorrect, you say, nope, move on. And so I think that is the kind of thing that the Justice Department needs to scrutinize. Go back and look at those questions and try to break them down and make sure there was nothing compound about them and ask each segment, do you host a television show? Is it on MSNBC? Is it on at 8 p.m.? And find out which part of it they disagree with. So it can be really tedious and meticulous, but that's what you have to do when you have these kinds of witnesses who are determined to be unhelpful.
Yeah, don't just leave it at, I don't recall whether I host a show on MSNBC. Kyle Chaney, senior legal affairs reporter for Politico, and the great Barbara McQuaid, former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. Thank you both for your insight and expertise tonight, guys.
Thank you, Alex.
Coming up, every single president since 1977 has seen his taxes audited by the IRS every year he was in office, except for one president. Guess who? Why mandatory presidential audits did not happen for President Trump until Democratic lawmakers began to ask some questions. The answer to that is next.
Hey, Keurig coffee drinkers. Did you know that the bold, smooth taste of Dunkin' cold coffee can be brewed in your Keurig coffee maker and enjoyed at home? Dunkin's cold K-Cup pods were crafted to be brewed hot and enjoyed cold. And of course, they're packed with the Dunkin' flavor you crave. Brew over ice and sip in seconds. Because the home with Dunkin' is where you want to be.
When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
We have breaking news in this day of breaking news. The January 6th committee has filed its final report in the House. And according to the committee, that report will be made public tonight, this evening. While we await that, however, there is this. Take a look at this. These are all of former President Barack Obama's tax returns from the year 2000 to the year 2015. We here at MSNBC dug them up using the rigorous investigative tool known as Googling Obama tax returns. And here are all of President Joe Biden's tax returns from the year 1998 to 2021. Again, all of them are public. All of them are online. You, as a citizen, can examine them, pore over them until your heart is content, if tax returns make your heart content. But on top of the longstanding tradition of voluntarily releasing taxes to the public, every president since the year 1977 has been required to undergo a mandatory IRS audit of his taxes while that president is in office. This week, two congressional committees revealed the blockbuster news that somehow, President Trump's taxes did not. They did not undergo that mandatory audit. Trump's taxes didn't get audited, in fact, until Democrats in the House of Representatives started asking questions. And that was in the year 2019, which was considerably after Donald Trump took office. And none of the audits of former President Trump's taxes since then have even been completed. It is the year 2022. So what happened here? The initial and most generous explanation for what could have happened here was that this mandatory audit process just wasn't working broadly. Given the fact that every president up until Trump publicly released his tax returns, you could see how these mandatory audits might have fallen through the cracks. I mean, they were already releasing them, right? But now, thanks to excellent reporting from Charlie Savage over at the New York Times, we know that that simply is not the case. Both Barack Obama and Joe Biden had their taxes audited by the IRS every year, even though their taxes were already public. So why, or rather how, did the one president since Richard Nixon to not publicly release his taxes, how did he not get audited? Who at the IRS let that happen? For the first 9 months of Trump's presidency, the IRS commissioner was an Obama appointee, a man named John Koskinen. He told the New York Times that his only involvement in Trump's tax returns in that time was making sure they were kept in a secure location. Okay. Then there was the interim commissioner that Trump appointed named David Cowder, who served for most of 2018. He actually held two jobs at once. He was both the IRS commissioner and an assistant treasury secretary simultaneously. So he was busy. And he did not respond to the New York Times request for comment about Trump's taxes. But then for the bulk of Trump's time in office, the IRS was run by a relatively unknown tax lawyer named Charles Rettig. President Trump appointed Rettig to the position after Rettig wrote an op-ed in Forbes magazine in 2016 defending then-candidate Trump's decision to not release his taxes. IRS commissioner terms are long, so Rettig literally just stepped down from that position in October of this year. And when it comes to these supposedly mandatory presidential audits, Rettig also told the New York Times this week that he did not attempt to intervene in Mr. Trump's audit. So we have two of Trump's former IRS commissioners saying, effectively, not it, and a third who hasn't responded to requests for comment. But under all of them, Trump's taxes didn't get audited until House Democrats started nosing around and asking questions. As a reminder, we are a week away from the year 2023. It's literally around the corner, and still, none of Trump's mandatory presidential audits have been completed. And to add to all of this, while the IRS was looking the other way for President Trump, or whatever the IRS was doing, somehow, two of Trump's top enemies, or at least enemies as he perceived them, former FBI Director James Comey and former acting FBI Director Andy McCabe, somehow, both of those men got chosen for a supposedly random and incredibly intense audit by the IRS. Out of the more than 150 million people who file taxes, only about 5,000 of them get picked for these intensive audits. 150 million, 5,000. And somehow, they were both picked. The IRS Inspector General said earlier this month that they had seen no evidence that those picks were anything but random. But just last month, we learned that President Trump repeatedly told at least one of his chiefs of staff that he wanted his enemies investigated by the IRS. Quote, among those Mr. Trump said we ought to investigate and get the IRS on were, you guessed it, former FBI Director James Comey and his deputy, Andrew McCabe. So, what was really happening in Trump's IRS? We're going to find out because Charlie Savage from the New York Times is going to join me to talk about all that and more coming right up. We have breaking news tonight. The January 6th committee's final report is out. It is 845 pages long. We have not had a chance to review all of those pages, of course. But for those following along here, there are several chapters, 8 to be exact. The first chapter is The Big Lie. The second, I just want to find 11,780 votes, presumably President Trump's pressure campaign on states. Chapter 3, Fake Electors and the President of the Senate Strategy. Chapter 4, Just Call It Corrupt and Leave the Rest to Me. These are great choice Trump quotes. Chapter 5, A Coup in Search of a Legal Theory. Chapter 6 is Be There Will Be Wild, President Trump's famous exhortation to his followers to come to the Capitol on January 6th. Chapter 7, 187 minutes of dereliction. That's reflecting the absolute silence from the White House during the January 6th insurrection. Chapter 8, an analysis of the attack. Joining me to discuss this breaking news is former U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan, Barb McQuaid. Barb, thank you for sticking around, and thank goodness you are available to talk about what is a magnum opus from the January 6th committee. 845 pages. There is going to be a lot to comb through. Let me just, we were talking about this at the end of our first or second conversation, which is how this body of evidence, 845 pages, could show the Justice Department something new, if at all. How do you see those investigations operating, which is to say, at one point, they were out of sync. It felt like the House committee was far ahead of the DOJ. There was some tension there, some announced tension in the press between the committee and the DOJ. It has felt like in recent weeks, the DOJ, under the leadership of Jack Smith, the special counsel, has become more aggressive. And in fact, some of the witnesses that were whose transcripts have been released have now testified to the DOJ. Now, as the House committee is winding its investigation down, how do you think the DOJ goes forward? And what do you think their timeline is, given the excess of evidence the American public now has?
I think in a case like this, the Justice Department is happy to have the information. But I think they're probably not happy that the information is also out in the public, because that makes their job a little bit harder. It means that witnesses can get their stories straight. They can start messaging around what they know to be the testimony out there to try to taint any future jury pool. They might try to intimidate witnesses or tamper with witnesses. So it's not great that all of this is out in the public domain, but it is what it is. Based on what we're hearing of reporting, the Justice Department has gone even beyond, I think, what the committee has been able to do, because they have some tools not available to the committee. Search warrants, grand juries, immunity. And we know that they used search warrants, for example, to get the cell phone content from John Eastman and from Jeffrey Clark. That's something that this committee just couldn't do. And so if, to the extent they were sending encrypted messages, that information is available to the committee. But I don't know that they're any more or less likely to charge crimes now than they were a week ago before any of this is out in the public domain. But I think seeing what's out there, you know, my ability to see it makes me have the opinion that charges are far more likely than I previously believed them to be, just because the evidence does appear to be so strong on the charges that they are referring. In terms of a timeline, I think it's difficult to know when they could be done with all of this, because in addition to what the committee has done, the Justice Department has to, one, anticipate cross-examination of these witnesses. That didn't happen at the committee. They have to make sure that they can comply with the rules of evidence. Hearsay is not admissible in court, so they have to go back to the firsthand witnesses to these things. There was no defense presentation at the January 6th committee. The DOJ has to anticipate potential defenses and try to listen to them, understand them, determine whether they'd be successful. And only then can they go forward with a case. They do have a realistic clock ticking, though, I think, because they need to have this all done, trial, sentencing, before, I think, January of 2025, when a new administration comes in, because a new president, a new DOJ could put an end to this whole thing. And so if you start with that and work your way back, I think they have to file charges by spring of 2023 at the latest.
That is an important flag to plant in the sand, Barb. I want to bring in now Charlie Savage, New York Times Washington correspondent. Charlie, thus far, the House Select Committee on January 6 has had kind of an open landscape to make the case that President Trump acted in support or incited an insurrection and the other charges, referrals that they made regarding his actions. They have not been challenged by a dueling committee. But one imagines when the House Republicans take over control of the lower chamber, we are going to see some kind of bizarro version of the House January 6th committee. Is that your expectation, that Republicans are going to try and use their chairmanship of these committees to effectively muddy the waters? Are we going to see a day where we're going to get an 846-page final report on the bizarro, from the bizarro Republican-led January 6th committee?
I do think the Republicans in the House will use their authority next year, their control of the gavel, to investigate this investigation. This is a play we've seen before with the original Russia investigation, eventually led by Special Counsel Mueller, delivering its findings about all the, you know, myriad ties between the Trump campaign and Russia, and finding that Russia had worked to get Trump elected and the Trump campaign expected to be, benefit from that interference. And then using its control of the Justice Department, the Trump administration, in the form of Attorney General Barr, appointed John Durham to investigate the investigation, to hunt for a basis to accuse it of being corrupt, chasing a number of conspiracy theories, a number of different ways to try to do that. And we're still expecting a final report from Mr. Durham some 4 years later. So the January 6th committee investigation almost certainly will be investigated by the House Republicans next year, and they will look for a basis to muddy it up. I think one place we're already seeing some signs of interest from them is Cassidy Hutchison, the White House aide, whose testimony was so damaging to Trump. But then there were supposedly Secret Service agents who disagreed with her portrayal of certain events. I think that'll be one focus they'll try to attack her.
Barb, what if the actual congressmen, some of whom, you know, including Kevin McCarthy and Jim Jordan, who are going to have leadership positions in the next Congress and have gotten ethics referrals from the January 6th committee? An ethics referral is one thing, but do you think that DOJ is looking more closely at their actions? I mean, can you imagine a strange twilight zone where those investigating the January 6th committee are in themselves being investigated by the DOJ?
Yes, I think it's quite likely they're under investigation. I mean, Jim Jordan and Kevin McCarthy, I mean, we know that they were having direct communications with Donald Trump on January 6th. I mean, at this point, I suppose they consider them to be witnesses, but I think they would want to know what they have to say. I'm sure they're going to get a request for an interview. Perhaps they'll get a grand jury subpoena. And the Justice Department has the ability to compel their testimony. It's highly sensitive to go after information from a sitting member of Congress, but they're not being targeted because they're members of Congress. They're being targeted because of their conduct and their conversations with Donald Trump on January 6th. So I don't see how you investigate this case without talking to them, at least. And so they can, maybe they're witnesses, maybe they're defendants, depending on how the evidence shakes out.
I want to ask Charlie, before we go, just a big picture question. The degree to which the January 6th committee exceeded expectations, the degree to which they were additive in terms of the information landscape around January 6th, how much they actually changed the conversation for a broader swath of the American public. What's your assessment there?
I think they did a good job. They surprised a lot of people who thought, we already know this stuff. People have already made their minds up one way or the other. You know, the video was on TV for all to see. People in the media were reconstructing the events of that day, et cetera. I mean, Trump was openly urging those people to go pressure the Congress and, you know, saying the rules didn't apply and they had to be strong. It was, just, you know, you were projecting onto it. The facts were there already.
Yeah.
And yet this committee really shaped the conversation, and its hearings were blockbusters. They were riveting television, and I think they kept this issue front and center for the year rather than allowing it to fade away behind so many other events that just keep coming.
Charlie Savage and Barb McQuaid, thank you for your time tonight. That does it for us.
When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.